The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei calls for the punishment of those behind the assassination of one of the country's top nuclear scientists. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that Tehran will respond to the terror attack targeting an Iranian nuclear scientist in due time. And thousands of protesters rally in the French city of Nantes to decry a security bill that they say gives more autonomy to police to use brutal tactics. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for those involved in the assassination of the country's prominent nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged relevant authorities to pursue the matter and mete out, quote, definitive punishment for those who ordered and perpetrated the crime. The leader said Fakhrizadeh was killed by criminal and ruthless mercenaries. Ayatollah Khamenei also called on officials to follow up on the technical and scientific activities of Fakhrizadeh in all sectors that he was working in. He further expressed condolences to the martyrdom of the eminent scientists. The Iranian president says the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, shows the enemy's desperation in the face of Iran's scientific progress. Hassan Rouhani said the terrorist act also indicates the enemy's failures on political fronts in the region, as well as across the world. He noted the assassination of the Iranian scientist also suggests the extent of the enemy's malice and grudge towards the Islamic Republic. Rouhani reiterated that such terror acts will not weaken Iranians' will to move on the path of scientific development. He also said that Iran will respond to this criminal act. Iran says there are serious indications of Israel's involvement in the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist and the Deputy Defense Minister Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Iran's ambassador to the UN made the comments in a letter to the world body's chief and the president of the UN Security Council. Majid Takht-Ravanchi urged them to strongly condemn the assassination and take the necessary measures against perpetrators. He also warned against any U.S. and Israeli adventurism against his country. Takht-Ravanchi said the Islamic Republic reserves the right to defend its people and to secure its national interests.
The assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has caused outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemy's desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said harsh revenge awaits the terrorist elements and all those behind the assassination. Chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, said retaliation and harsh punishment for the perpetrators are already on the agenda. Salami said the terrorist act was plotted and directed by the Israeli regime. In a tweet, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there were serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in a 2018 presentation by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he repeated Tel Aviv's baseless allegations against Tehran's nuclear program.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The New York Times also quoted three intelligence officials as saying that Israel was behind the terrorist attack. Hossein Dehghan, a military advisor to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, said Israel is seeking to intensify pressure on Iran with the aim of provoking a full-fledged war. The former defense minister said Iran will descend like lightning on the killers of the country's scientists and will make them regret their actions. The head of the Iranian judiciary's High Council for Human Rights said Fakhrizadeh's assassination was aimed at hindering the country's scientific progress.
What is noteworthy from my point of view about the assassination attempt made today in Tehran was that there is a serious will by the Iranians' enemy to prevent the improvement an advancement of the Iranian people. They are going to put hurdles on our way.
Fakhrizadeh was also leading a team tasked with developing one of Iran's first kits for coronavirus diagnosis. The plot to assassinate him was not the first, as he had survived several such attempts in the past years. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under the intense scrutiny of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions says the assassination of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is a violation of international human rights law.
An extraterritorial targeted killing outside an armed conflict is a violation of international human rights law prohibiting the arbitrary deprivation of life and a violation of the UN Charter prohibiting the use of force extraterritorially in times of peace.
Former director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has also described the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist as a highly reckless criminal act. In a series of tweets, John Brennan said that Fakhrizadeh's murder risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict. Meanwhile, Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned Fakhrizadeh's murder as a heinous attack sponsored by the U.S. and Israel. Hezbollah's deputy leader also stressed that the assassination was part of a war in Iran and the region. Sheikh Naim Wassam said that the response to the murder is in Iran's hands. Yemen's Ansarullah and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement also condemned the attack. The U.S. Secretary of State says that Washington will continue to use sanctions against foreign suppliers that provide missile-related materials and technology to Iran. Mike Pompeo's comments came after the U.S. imposed economic sanctions on two Chinese and two Russian firms that Washington claims have supported the development of Iran's missile program. Pompeo said these companies are accused of co-transferring sensitive technology and items to Iran. He noted that they will be subject to restrictions on U.S. government aid and on their exports for 2 years. Meanwhile, China said it had lodged stern representations with the U.S. over the sanctions. Beijing stressed that it would firmly safeguard its legitimate rights and interests. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says recent restrictive measures have been effective in slowing down the coronavirus outbreak in the country. Rouhani hailed the nation's contribution and urged people to help raise awareness about the disease more. He also called on the people to take the virus seriously and to pay more attention to measures like self-isolation. Rouhani underlined that indoor gatherings have proven to be very contagious. He said gatherings of more than 15 people is prohibited in cities categorized as red. Touching on the restrictions, Rouhani emphasized that businesses may resume their activities after the current partial lockdown. He said, however, that this does not mean returning to normalcy, which will not be possible any sooner than March. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of the French city of Nantes to decry a controversial security bill that bans sharing the images of police officers. Brief clashes erupted as police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. The protesters voiced opposition to the global security bill, which, if passed, would illegalize filming and photographing officers on duty with malicious purposes. It would also require the faces of law enforcement forces be blurred upon publication by ordinary citizens or the media. Proposed legislation has drawn fierce criticism and sparked a wave of protests earlier this week in several French cities, including the capital Paris. The protesters say the new law would give more autonomy to local police to use brutal tactics. Concerns over violent policing have surfaced once again in France after CCTV captured three officers violently assaulting a black man over coronavirus face mask. Murtaza Jaffer takes a closer look as France continues to struggle with its policing of minorities.
Outrage in France after police are filmed savagely beating a black music producer at his studios after accusing him of not wearing a face mask. A criminal inquiry has been launched following the 13-minute assault, which left the victim with a deep gash to the head and a torn tendon. Fearing for his safety, the victim has asked to be identified by his first name only and has said he was racially abused by the officers who used the N-word repeatedly. Police originally arrested Michael for not wearing a face mask, but later charged him with assault.
I'm sorry to say this, but my client had the luck of having these videos to report these acts, which are isolated but still exist. If we didn't have them, he would have been detained, because it's his word against the officers. We know perfectly that it's the words of the officers that holds.
During the ordeal, Michael was also put into a chokehold, which raised further outrage. Campaigners have long been trying to have the move outlawed after a number of deaths in police custody.
Les images, elles sont inqualifiables. Elles sont extrêmement choquantes.
The pictures are unspeakable. They're extremely shocking. And as soon as I found out about them, about what happened, I asked for the police officers to be suspended. And as soon as the facts are established by the courts, because there is an investigation, I will ask for these police officers to be dismissed. They have sullied the uniform of the Republic.
A separate inquiry has been launched after police raided a refugee camp in central Paris. The Interior Minister's office described the scenes as shocking. France is in the midst of a battle over policing. Last week, President Emmanuel Macron's government introduced a new security bill, making it illegal to publish images of officers that might subject them to, quote, physical or psychological harm. Human rights groups are outraged, accusing authorities of censorship, giving police the freedom to use disproportionate force. The incident follows a string of racist profiling and discrimination in the policing of the coronavirus lockdown. Earlier this year, two youths lost their lives in incidents involving police, which led to days of unrest in suburbs populated by minority communities.
Religious leaders are calling for greater efforts by EU authorities to tackle growing levels of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism across the 27-nation bloc. During a video conference organized by the European Commission, they also criticized the EU's treatment of refugees. Jerome Hughes reports.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticized for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalization, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The release of a Palestinian hunger striker this week has been described as an encouragement for those who are struggling against Israel's notorious detention policy in the occupied territories. As we'll see in the next report, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras believes his protest action has been successful.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it. They play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped, and taken back inside for another six-month period.
When it comes to prisoners, Israel has detained many prisoners, including minors, without charge or trial. For those who are held under this policy, there's no possibility of appeal or even knowing what accusations are brought against them. Israeli forces in the occupied territories can practically detain anyone and hold them indefinitely. As the health condition of Al-Akhras worsened over the past weeks, calls actually grew on Israel to release him and other administrative detainees. But as always, Israel remains defiant. The regime has also refused to take measures to improve extremely poor conditions in its jails.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia are the main culprits on the issue of Takfiri groups.
On the issue of Takfiri orientations, the main crime was committed by the Americans as well as by the Saudis who followed them. The Saudis paid them money and they helped and supported them. The Americans committed another crime as well. They sent their army to Muslim countries with the excuse of the presence of such terrorist groups. They sent their forces to Afghanistan, to Syria, and to other countries. As for other countries such as Iraq, they have been thinking about sending their forces, but the Iraqi youth and the Iraqi believers will not allow them to do so. Their legitimate zeal and enthusiasm will prevent the Americans from exerting their influence, God willing. But they have this plan anyway, and they're after infiltrating these countries. Of course, wherever they set foot in, they caused insecurity and destruction. They have really destroyed the infrastructures of these countries. They have caused insecurity. They have waged domestic wars, and they have done something to occupy the minds of governments with these thoughts so that they will not be able to carry out their main duties. They have really destroyed crops and cattle. His aim everywhere is to destroy crops and cattle. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 205. The ayah is about these people in the true sense of the word, and they have really done these things.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In my opinion, Unity Week is very important, and unity is a cure for many maladies of the Islamic Ummah. In the present time, the disastrous war in Yemen, during which that oppressed nation has been subject to bombardments on the streets, in the markets, in their houses, at school, and in public ceremonies for 5 years, this is not a minor incident. Rather, it is a very grave one. The Saudis are really acting in a very cruel manner on this matter.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Pirates are abducting bigger groups of seafarers in the Gulf of Guinea these days.
There has been a clear surge in the number of seafarers kidnapped by pirates so far this year, according to multiple reports by international observers.
Now, the latest global piracy report by the ICC International Maritime Bureau shows a 40% increase in the number of kidnappings reported in the Gulf of Guinea. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and I'd like to introduce our new colleague, Ms. Ibrahim Abdi Karim.
Hello, I am happy to be with you in the program. In this show, we will take you to the Gulf of Guinea, where over 90% of global kidnappings take place.
And in the second part of our show, we'll delve into how the Anglo-American PLC has caused widespread lead poisoning in Zambia for decades. Stay with us.
Gulf of Guinea piracy. Piracy and armed robbery, crimes notoriously reminiscent of the Gulf of Guinea, bordering more than 3,700 miles of West African coast between Guinea and Angola. Pirates and armed robbers operate off at least 8 countries in the Gulf of Guinea: Nigeria, Benin, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Togo, and Gabon.
We are currently working with them to transition production into those countries. And if Nigeria has a capability to manufacture specialized ribs, then the rest of the region should be supporting Nigeria in buying those vessels from Nigeria. And that way the region has the ability to establish a maritime ecostructure that will feed off itself and work as one system.
The International Maritime Bureau sounded the alarm and called for international cooperation after tracking an unprecedented rise in kidnappings in the region in 2019, up to 50% from the previous year.
Piracy and criminality continue in this vast and strategically significant body of water, despite some international efforts to contain the pirates. The criminal tactics of pirates and armed robbers are also evolving.
We are now joined by Dr. Okafo Yarwood, a maritime safety and security expert with a regional focus on the Gulf of Guinea, to listen to her view on how piracy in the Gulf of Guinea has transformed.
It is now more like an organized crime whereby there are groups. Elites are actually also represented in the system that are able to do the negotiation, that have access to perhaps offshore accounts where the ransom is paid, and then they're able to communicate to a different group that is able to confirm that the ransom has been paid. And then they also have people that work in the communities that have access to navigation skills and can actually accommodate without sometimes raising suspicion of who the people they are holding, you know, where these victims are usually kept. So it's currently, unfortunately, no longer just about economic marginalization, but it is now a full-blown business network that have different spheres and different categories of people involved.
Thanks for that, Dr. Okafo Yarwood, a maritime safety and security expert.
Oil tankers are often the targets of attacks, given the fact that the Gulf borders many African countries with sizable oil and gas industries. With the oil prices crashing in 2014, the pirates have shifted their tactics and preferred to kidnap seafarers for ransom instead of getting engaged in a complicated operation to steal oil. The shipping company or the hostages' families will have to pay ransom for the victims to be released. But the abducted captain, first mate, or chief engineer are not the only victims in this crime. Coastal communities suffer the dire consequences of piracy, and the most vulnerable sectors of the society are trapped in a cycle of crime and poverty.
The environment has also been polluted and degraded to the point that people, fishers, farmers that would usually make their living from farming or from fishing are no longer able to do so due to the level of pollution in the region. So, for example, the extensiveness of oil pollution in the Niger Delta, one of the highest or most polluted regions in the world or deltas in the world, is such that about 40% of the mangrove is oiled. And in the case of selected communities across the region, there are people that depend on, say, catching periwinkles, women primarily, from the mangroves that are no longer able to do that because of oil destruction.
The opportunistic criminal groups are motivated by profits and not politics. It's worth mentioning that the influx of multinational oil companies and the efforts to disrupt their exploitation of Nigerian oil has had its role to play in the creation of culture of piracy.
Now today, piracy goes beyond Nigeria to areas of the coast of Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, and the emerging hotspots of Togo and Benin.
Our radar system and our lookouts, we have the potential to see any threats that are approaching us, and you know, miles out. So before any piracy issue would take place, we will have notification well in advance.
Now there are concerns that terrorist organizations such as Boko Haram or the Takfiri Daesh West African province could use the tactics employed by the pirates to pursue their extremist agenda.
After all, on the other side of the continent, Somali pirates have been accused of smuggling weapons and cargo for terrorists.
However, in 2013, regional heads of state of 25 Western Central African countries came together in Yaoundé, and they were able to agree and sign three strategic documents. They had a memorandum of understanding. They had the Yaoundé Code of Conduct, and also a political declaration that centers around issue of addressing holistically issues of maritime insecurity in the region. So I think it has gone beyond relying on colonial powers.
Piracy in the region also has a harsh impact on the environment. As pirates hastily load oil onto small and rudimentary vessels, spills could contaminate the Gulf, hurting fishing and other sources of food and livelihood. There are also concerns that the contamination could reach freshwater sources for drinking and farming. Yet piracy does not look like it is on the path to leave the region.
Last year, how many attacks did you do?
Last year, of course, I struck no less than 15 attacks, because we have nowhere to start from. Sometimes we hijack the ships to get money.
Usually, how much is it to release a ship?
Depends on the ship. We can even say 200 million, bring 900 million for us.
And when you keep the member of the crews, you keep them on the ship, on the boat, or you...
Sir, I'll try for you.
With the Gulf being unsafe, critical industries like fishing and tourism cannot thrive, leading to economic repercussions on the local populations. Cancer and asthma are also among the long-term health complications in such an environment. With the governments bringing in less revenue, the cost of living goes higher, causing more poverty and potentially more crime.
I think that some of the key reasons why the threat, and of course other illicit threats, is present in the region is primarily due to, you could say, economic hardship. You could say due to a sense of economic and political exclusion and economic marginalization, when people feel that they are sitting in the midst of plenty, but they are not necessarily benefiting from what is the resources that has been extracted from their region. And so it all began as a way of all these things resulted in what I would call animosity against the state.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic has appeared, the situation has exacerbated in the Gulf. The rise in piracy attacks appears to correlate with the spread of the virus in January until global disconfinement in June.
Now, the rise in attacks is explained by the freeze in activities on the docks due to quarantining and a sharp decrease in income for already fragile shore populations.
What do you think about people doing maritime piracy? What is your opinion about this?
It's due to joblessness. After your years in school, you came going back home now, you don't have any work to do. What do you think will come to your mind? And you cannot go to the river and go fishing any longer again. So if you have any way to go there, you go and do piracy. If you die from there, well, it is the will of God, let it be. So joblessness lead to this piracy.
Lack of resilience in the infrastructure of port security and a diminished ability to react to unexpected events like the spread of COVID-19 are among the factors increasing piracy.
So what should regional states do?
They should ensure that as they explore oil, for example, they should keep in mind that oil is not the only marine resources. They should take advantage of the potential potential of developing coastal tourism, for instance, investing in the fisheries sector, investing and ensuring that the collaboration and the cooperation that they are really putting so much effort on and emphasis sometimes on piracy and armed robbery at sea is also extended to issues of illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, because actually that also poses a very significant threat to the livelihood of the people.
Now, thanks a lot for that, Dr. Okafuri Arwood, the maritime security and safety expert, and you're all looking forward to an end of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. And it's that time in our program where we bring you a collection of news and events from across Africa. What do you have today for us, Ekram?
Thank you, Henya. Today we've got 6 different news from different parts of Africa. And now, on to the first one. The Iranian documentary, No Place for Angels, won the Safinaz Foundation Special Award at the Kenya Film Festival. The documentary, No Place for Angels, directed by Sam Kalantari and produced by Hamed Shakibania and Mohsin Shah Mohammed Mirab, won the special award of the Safinaz Foundation. Ethiopia's Tigray crisis. Rocket hit outskirts of Eritrea's capital. The leader of Ethiopia's Tigray region has confirmed the firing of missiles at neighboring Eritrea's capital and is threatening many more, marking a huge escalation as the deadly fighting in the northern Ethiopia between regional forces and the federal government now spills over an international border. Trove of a sarcophagi, unearthed in Egypt. More than 100 intact sarcophagi have been unearthed near Cairo, dating back more than 2,500 years. The latest finding comes just over a month after the archaeologists in the area found 59 other well-preserved and sealed wooden coffins. Algeria's approved new constitution after referendum. Algerians have approved constitutional reforms in the referendum, though with a record low turnout, the country's Constitutional Council has announced. The referendum held on November 1st was widely seen as the government's maneuver to neutralize the Hirak protest movement, which had called for a boycott of the plebiscite. Racism and propaganda. Africans in China complain of discrimination in the time of COVID. Africans in China have complained of harassment, discrimination, and even eviction while being accused of carrying the coronavirus since early April. Now, on to Kenya. Kenya named Africa's top tourist destination in 2020. Kenya is Africa's 2020 leading tourist destination. This is according to the World Travel Association, which made the announcement during the inaugural African Winners Day. In the World Travel Awards, which were also presented, Kenya Tourism Board was named the best tourism board in the continent. That is it for today. Please stay tuned for more.
Anglo poisoning of Zambians.
Widespread lead poisoning from a mine operated by a London-based multinational mining company has recently attracted attention after a legal action by Zambians.
Anglo-American PLC is being sued in a court in South Africa for its operation of the mine in the northern Zambian city of Kabwe from 1925 to 1974. The remnants of the mine are still poisoning many today.
When we come for work, we protect ourselves by putting our home attires in bags or plastics and then wear work clothes. We leave our work clothes here and bath and then change into clothes which we go home in. We also drink milk as a protective measure after work.
Now, A group of Zambian women and children have filed a suit to seek justice for generations of children poisoned by widespread lead contamination from the Kabwe mine in the soil, dust, water, and vegetation.
Represented by 13 plaintiffs in the Johannesburg court, around 100,000 people are demanding not just compensation, but also a cleanup of the area.
One question would be, how did Anglo operate that led to such a disaster? We have Mr. Abayomi Azikwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire and the co-founder of the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice. We ask him to tell us more on that.
The system was designed to extract as much natural resources from Zambia, which was formerly known as Northern Rhodesia, and to pay the African workers slave wages. They did not care about the health and safety of the people there. And it's quite interesting now, since the independence of South Africa and the ANC has come to power, that Anglo-American no longer has its headquarters in Johannesburg. They moved to London right after the ANC took power.
Today, more than 76,000 people live in lead-contaminated areas of Kabwe, amounting to two-thirds of the population there.
Originally known as Broken Hill, the mine became a source of poisonous lead leaking from its smelter, ore processing, and tailing dams.
Now we are joined by Mr. Karavanos. Sir, you've been to Kabwe. How serious is the situation there?
Well, I've been to dozens of toxic places on the planet in many, many countries. And Kabwe stands out for a number of reasons. One is the extent of contamination. The soil level is contaminated with lead from historic mining at very, very high levels. But that's not enough. The second issue is the people living there are readily involved with lead in the sense that they're always touching it, living on top of it, breathing it. So we have very high exposure. We measured lead in soil. We measured lead in blood of the children. We also tested some pilot remediations, meaning solutions. What's a fast, cost-effective way to fix the problem? And we did find very, very high levels of lead. For example, lead in soil is commonly measured, and the unit is 400 parts per million. Well, we measured lead in soil right in people's front yard of their homes at levels of 4,000 and 10,000 parts per million.
Lead leak into the local environment was caused due to deficiencies in the design and systems of operation and control of. The multinational company is to blame for two-thirds of the contamination in the area about 60 miles north of the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The world's biggest lead operation did not come to an end until 1994, 20 years after Zambia nationalized lead mining. But what did the government do in the face of such aggression?
Well, they did take action, but it was not adequate. They were faced with an inherited socioeconomic situation in the entire region of Southern Africa. It's important to understand that South Africa, which was a settler, colonial, imperialist system.
I'm a little disappointed in all my travels there and discussions with the ministries that the government hasn't taken a more active role in investigating the harmful effects of lead. It could be that the government is overwhelmed with other issues of health and healthcare and a variety of issues that affect low and middle income countries. But I'm sometimes disappointed that the government of Zambia is not working more to either move these people out of the contaminated zone or to offer some remediation.
Anglo did nothing. Although it was pretty well aware of the risks of lead pollution from the mine and the measures that were required to prevent and address it. Living in lead-contaminated areas has its hazards for the local communities, such as infertility, brain damage, and in some cases, death. Here is a father recounting how his child is dealing with disability to learn due to lead poisoning.
We started seeing changes in her behavior, especially in learning. At school, she started becoming naughty, not listening to us, very dull to school, many other things.
When we come for work, we protect ourselves by putting our home attires in bags or plastics and then wear work clothes. We leave our work clothes here and bath and then change into clothes which we go home in. We also drink milk as a protective measure after work.
The lead pollution is in the soil, where children play and two-year-olds have the highest level of lead in their blood.
Some young children even have levels more than 20 times higher than the U.S. threshold.
This is while there is no level of lead exposure that is known to be harmful without effects.
It's the world capitalist system that is responsible. They did not take into consideration the health and well-being of the masses of people who lived in these areas, who worked for these large multinational corporations. And it's not just in Africa. We have the same problem in the United States. Lead poisoning, particularly among children, is a major health hazard in many urban areas throughout the United States.
Anglo American has stated that it will defend its position vigorously in the court. This is while its human rights policy headline states that where we have caused or contributed to adverse human rights impacts, we will contribute to their remediation as appropriate. So how will the lawsuit go and what can be done to save the region?
Yes, it's my judgment that it's virtually impossible to say that the owners and the operators of the mine had no idea this was such a dangerous material. Again, we're talking 1960s, 70s, 80s, lead is very well established. So it's, I think, a little silly to think that we didn't know that this was a dangerous material and that we didn't know what we were doing was harming people. So I think that's extremely naive. And I think maybe the lawsuit and the subsequent court investigation will come to that conclusion.
This is not the first time the multinational is being sued in Africa.
In 2018, Anglo and five other companies paid about $390 million to settle a class action by former gold miners suffering from the respiratory disease silicosis.
Now today, Anglo American PLC is based in the UK, but the lawsuit was filed in South Africa because of the time of the mine's operation. It was headquartered in Johannesburg.
According to the class action lawsuit, Anglo had a duty of care to protect existing and future generations of residents of Kabwe, and it is liable for sustainable emissions of lead into the local environment. The 13 representative plaintiffs include children with very high blood lead levels.
Previous studies have indicated that we have a number of children whose blood lead levels are higher than 10 micrograms per deciliter, and 10 micrograms per deciliter is a World Health Organization standard that is anticipated. At least if it is below, then at least you know that the children and the adults are going to be in a health environment.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Till we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Ibrahim, and the entire team.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming. So we'll start off with our first question. Can we talk about the role of fathers in bringing up their children?
Yes, of course. We need to, in fact.
Okay.
Considering father's presence being lesser than the mother's, especially at home during the day, We shouldn't disregard them in the picture of Islamic upbringing. You know, usually fathers take it for granted, mothers will do everything, right?
All that work,
but
yes.
Father's role is very, very important in the upbringing of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I would like to point out and mention the some points regarding the rights of children from the father.
Mm-hmm.
The father, what he has to do, he has to enact these rights.
Okay.
The first one is from Risalat al-Hukuk of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Right.
A father should not forget that the child is his, and the child's good or bad deeds will be ascribed to him.
Mm,
you know, true. Like as the generation goes further, whose son is he?
Yes.
The deeds will be ascribed to him.
Back to the father, true.
Yeah. The second point is that a father is responsible for guiding the child to obey Allah and to teach him and educate him.
All right.
And to teach him and educate him, like for example, to teach him Quran. Hadith mentions that the father is the one to teach the child Quran and the writing also. Teach the child how to write, as in a physical activity.
Okay.
The child can learn from the father physically also, not only spiritually.
Alright.
Not only
physically meaning?
As in, for example, teaching him some sports.
Okay.
Teaching him, like, for example, you know, like football or archery or...
True.
This kind of things.
Yeah, it kind of it even builds up a bond between the father and the. Otherwise, because the father is always out, so it kind of keeps the father on one side.
But these
things would even keep up, you know, make a bond between the child.
Yeah, that's very
the
important. Then also, a father should not be indifferent to the result of the needs of his child. There will be rewards for the child's good deeds and punishment for the bad deeds of the child. For the father also. On the day of judgment, he'll be accorded that how he raised his child.
So isn't the first point a bit similar to the third point? You know, when you say that that the child is his, so the sins or the mistakes that the child does will be ascribed to the father, so he'll have to, like, be answerable for the sins as well. Is it a bit similar,
like,
or are
I
you
guess
trying to make a different point?
maybe a different one, in a way that in the first one, it'll generations will be like identified with the father.
With the father.
Maybe
okay.
in this world. Mm-hmm. But here, also in the hereafter, he'll be accorded.
All right, okay. Right?
So the good deeds that he plays a role in, and here it gives emphasis especially to these kind of, you know, religiosity of a child
okay.
based on the halal upbringing.
Mm-hmm, true.
How much he earns a lawful livelihood to make his children to be able to take the truth, able to accept the truth. It's very important.
Okay, this is Al Mukhalfan. Let's take a break. Dear listeners, stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. So we were talking about the father's role in the upbringing of the children, and you mentioned that he should know his roles and the rights of the children on the father, and that, you know, he's responsible for the children's actions, and that he should know that it's his child, and all the mistakes and the sins that a child does is ascribed to him. And, you know, he shouldn't be indifferent to the child's actions because he'll be answerable in the hereafter as well. Should we continue?
Yes, and another right that we can say a child has on the father, and the father should enact this right of his, is that a father should do his best to raise the child so that his excuse is acceptable both to the child and to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
Like he should do his best.
Yes. So in hereafter, the child shouldn't say that my father didn't, you know, raise me properly. And on the other hand, he should, you know, he should have an excuse in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well.
That he did his best.
Yes, that he did
but
his best.
But then something was out of his control,
yes,
for
true.
Example.
Yes.
So in addition to all these things, fathers play an important role in the child's development, like mothers also. Their involvement in the child's life ensures that the child has a very good upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to point out some fathers who are, you know, like we can emulate from their exemplifying us.
Okay.
And they show us exceptional traits of fatherhood that we can learn is from the Holy Quran.
All right, yes.
So,
absolutely.
One of them is Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
His attentiveness towards his child, as far as we come to know through his supplications.
Okay.
Through his du'as in the Holy Quran. They're very beautiful du'as, you know, in the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Like to point out a few. Rabbi ja'alni muqima salat wa min dhurriyati, Rabbana taqabbal du'ai.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rabbana inni askantu min dhurriyati.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is that, you know, like make my descendants also, you know, keep up prayer.
Okay.
And please accept mm-hmm. my prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, which is very beautiful, is actually even Mufassirin say that if you want your child to be loved by everyone, you can recite this dua.
All
and
right.
I myself take a very much importance in it, especially when my child goes to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I want the teachers to respect and love the child so that the child can also have this understanding that she is, you know, respected and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And she also learns faster, and also she feels good to go to school.
Okay.
Yeah, so Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam becomes a father at a very late age, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he was delighted at the gift of fatherhood, which Allah mm-hmm. subhanahu wa ta'ala has bestowed upon him. And despite this age gap, Prophet Ibrahim showed interest in his son's viewpoint.
Yes.
When he told his sons of Allah's decree on the sacrifice, that's a big deal, yeah?
It's a very big deal.
Like to share it out that, you know, to his young son, and look at the age gap difference.
Yes.
So it's an excuse. It's no more an excuse, I mean, for the, you know, fathers out there who have such a big age gap with their children.
And I guess it even shows the closeness they had, even though they had a very big age gap.
Yeah.
I think he had made that bond with his son, that even though he, first of all, he shared a very important, something very important with him. And the way Prophet Ismail even replies back, like, as if he understood his father very well,
yeah,
you know, like
right.
if you see the youngster,